We fear that the extreme weather will cause further damage, destruction, and potential loss of life.
Heavy rain hits heavily populated refugee camps. It's Monday, June 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You can also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia confronts foreign investments and security. Exploring capitalism, Asian style. A Uyghur restaurant caters to Muslims. A meat-free burger. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The first monsoons are drenching Bangladesh, and aid agencies report the relentless heavy downpours are causing havoc in the Cox's Bazar district. That's where nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees from neighboring Myanmar are living on barren hills in congested and fragile conditions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The worst fears of humanitarian agencies are coming true. Their predictions that the monsoon season would have a devastating impact on the Rohingya settlements have come to pass. In recent days, the agencies report some 11,000 people have been affected by torrential rains that have caused heavy flooding and landslides in Cox's Bazar. The agencies report the rains and wind speeds of up to 70 kilometers per hour have caused torrents of mud and clay to slide down deforested hills, damaging and destroying shelters in their path. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Andre Mahecic says several people have been injured and one child is confirmed dead.
Given the scope of the refugee population, the sheer size of the settlements and the challenging terrain, we fear that the extreme weather will cause further damage, destruction and potential loss of life. Based on aerial mapping of the settlements, we estimate up to 200,000 refugees could be at risk of landslides and floods and still need to be moved to safer areas.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says access to some of the Rohingya camps has been cut off, making it difficult to assess the needs. Red Cross spokesman Matthew Cochran says sodden and unstable hills have collapsed, destroying latrines and carrying sludge through the camps. He calls this a major concern.
We're already seeing increases in acute watery diarrhea, and the risk of an outbreak of waterborne diseases is now a serious likelihood. I mean, obviously, this has been something that agencies have been warning since the beginning of the crisis and since the cusp of the storm season.
Aid agencies are scaling up their operations. They say they are working around the clock to try to mitigate risks of landslides and flooding and to prevent injury and death in the highly congested refugee settlements. Nearly 700,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh in August to escape mass violations and persecution in Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya from a previous exodus also are living in Cox's Bazar. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that are currently trending on our website. That's voanews.com. Trump renews defense of North Korea agreement. Beijing is ready to retaliate against U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. Cambodian court postpones trial of Australian who flew a drone at a rally. French and British ships sail to disputed Asian sea and rile China. U.S. lobsters are a target of China's threatened tariffs. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. And while you're online, visit the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia's Commonwealth Bank has agreed to pay a $530 million fine for breaching anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing laws. The scandal relates to more than 53,000 suspect transactions that the bank did not immediately report to authorities. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
If approved by the federal court, this will be the largest civil penalty in Australian corporate history. At the heart of the case were so-called smart cash machines that allowed customers to anonymously deposit and transfer money. Thousands of suspect transactions, over $7,600 each, weren't referred to the authorities as required by law. An investigation by the Australian Transaction Reports and Analysis Centre, the Federal Financial Intelligence Agency, along with state and federal police, found the machines were being used to launder the proceeds of crime. Australian Treasurer Scott Morrison says the bank must now rebuild its reputation.
It is for them to rebuild that trust. It is for them to make these admissions. It is for them to incur these penalties and get on with the job of restoring trust in the conduct of the CBA. And this, I think, is another important step towards doing that.
The Commonwealth Bank said its actions weren't deliberate, but it understood the seriousness of the mistakes it had made. It had reportedly been anticipating a fine of about $285 million. Professor Ian Ramsey is a director at Melbourne University's Centre for Corporate Law.
For AUSTRAC, it's able to demonstrate that there has been serious failings by Commonwealth Bank, one of our major financial institutions. I'm sure what the bank did not want was a very lengthy trial where every day more evidence is brought before the court and then promptly reported in the media of systemic serious failings by CBA.
AUSTRAC said the penalty would send a strong message to Australia's financial industry. Since February, it's been investigated by a Royal Commission, Australia's highest form of inquiry, which has already unearthed widespread misconduct within the banking and financial services sector.
Phil Mercer is also following national security concerns in Australia, which are likely to result in Chinese telecom giant Huawei from being blocked from a major 5G mobile wireless project there. That's according to local media reports. They say intelligence sources believe the company is a cyber espionage risk. Analysts think the move could further aggravate tensions between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner.
Australia's The Financial Review is reporting that Huawei will be stopped from helping to develop the next-generation mobile phone network. The newspaper says that intelligence agencies are warning ministers in Canberra about the security implications of allowing a company with suspected links to the Chinese government to be involved in a project of such national importance. There's been no official comment from the Australian government, but the Federal Attorney General Christian Porter says laws are in place to ban companies from sensitive ventures.
There's a process in place and there is an ability to exclude an organisation or organisations from taking part in that process on national security grounds.
It was concerns of that type that prompted Australia to ban Huawei from taking part in Australia's new national broadband network in 2012. The Chinese technology giant has insisted it's independent from authorities in Beijing. Huawei Australian Chairman John Lord says the company remains in talks with Canberra about the 5G project.
Government officials have raised no real concerns other than to seek more information from us about the way 5G is being formed, its similarities to 4G, how Huawei intends to take 5G forward. So we're not really getting any concerns expressed to us at all, other than reports in the media.
Huawei has also lost a contract to build a 4,000-kilometre cable between the Solomon Islands, a South Pacific island nation, and Sydney, following rare intervention by Australian spy chiefs. They were worried about a Chinese company gaining access to Australia's internet infrastructure. Canberra is also hoping to pass foreign interference laws to counter alleged meddling by governments and individuals. The move comes amid rising fears in Australia over the influence of China in its domestic affairs. Earlier this month, media reports detailed allegations allegedly contained in a top-secret document that China had tried to influence Australia's political parties for the past decade, as well as every level of government. In response, Beijing has previously accused Australia of being anti-China. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening in Asia, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has condemned soldiers who flew a Nazi swastika flag above a military vehicle while on duty in Afghanistan in 2007. A photo of the incident was just recently made public. Military commanders have insisted appropriate action was taken quickly at the time. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's the start of our week. We're glad you're joining us for it on VOA Asia. News of Asian economic growth, especially in China, has often topped the business headlines. Part of the reporting deals with the growth of entrepreneurism as well as capitalist expansion. VOA's Steve Norman speaks with Philip Lawrence, University of Sydney, about the Asian version of capitalism and whether it is better or worse than Western-style capitalism.
With capitalism, it's so rooted in history, and the nature of capitalism is formed by things that have happened well into the past. And so you can't change your history. Asia can't change their history. So they effectively, their model of capitalism is what they have to live with because of their history.
Does that make it better?
Whether it's going to be better or whether it is better, I think will be sort of played out in the long term. The main question that I was trying to pose in the paper was that, is the Asian model of capitalism, with the very narrow ownership of major parts of the economy, is that going to be a structure that's going to prevent wild fluctuations?
Yeah, that's right. Do Asian economies rise and fall the same way that Western economies do?
I think they rise and fall in a more subtle wave motion, and looking at the impacts that have occurred in the Asian economies, they have tended to be caused by external forces rather than Asian forces. If you take the global financial crisis that occurred in 2008, I mean that happened because of forces within the US. Now, if you look at what's happening in Europe today, that's happening because of forces that's happening within Europe. But if you look at what's happened in Asia in the past when they've had financial conniptions, they've really been forces that have occurred by external forces that have acted on Asia.
As the Asian economies develop, could they end up with the same sorts of problems that Western economies have had?
In the back of my head, I'm saying I don't think so, because of some fundamental characteristics of the history of Asian economies. I just got off the phone to some people in Europe, and I was explaining to them that if you look back at the basis behind Western capitalism, Western economies, a lot of it is based on the potential of future wealth of a company or an organization. So you're buying, speculatively buying into what's going to happen in the future. Whereas I think the mentality in Asia is to trade with what you have today.
Well, from my perspective, I always see that we think of in the West stockholders, you know, kind of absentee owners through stocks, and then over there these multi-generational family companies, and then plus the state-owned enterprises that aren't anything like what we have over here, largely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, for example, I talk to Asian companies a lot, you know, from levels, you know, from the lowest levels in the firm right up to the owners of the companies, and these are multi-billion-dollar companies, and quite regularly you'll see in the company almost at every level of the company, right down to a driver, a delivery driver, will be somehow related to the owner, and it's almost as if when decisions are made for an investment, you know, a major investment, could be, you know, a couple of billion dollars in investment, then they realize that they're playing with the future lives of the family.
And they don't take risks then, is that it?
And as a result, the risks they take are very, very, very considered.
Philip Lawrence of the University of Sydney speaking with VOA's Steve Norman. Coming up, keeping tradition at a restaurant. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump renewed his defense Sunday of the agreement he reached with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, saying it has already led to an end to Pyongyang's nuclear tests and, quote, rockets flying all over the place. You need only to go to one place for the day's news, VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, restaurants are getting into the religious spirit by offering a special menu for iftar when Muslims around the world break their fasts after sunset. VOA's Ariane Budianto narrates this report by Virginia Gunawan in the Washington suburb of Fairfax, Virginia.
During Ramadan, Irkins becomes a hotspot for Uyghurs, a mainly Muslim Turkic ethnic group who live primarily in northwest China's Xinjiang Autonomous Region. The Fairfax, Virginia restaurant blends the influences of China and border countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Mongolia in its menu, all prepared according to Islamic rules.
I mean, we trust him, and we trust that they use all halal stuff.
The many flavors of halal food in America are a result of the increasing diversity of immigrants from Muslim countries. Irkins brings a little taste of home for the Uyghurs diaspora.
For the moment, this is the only Uyghur restaurant that I know of in Fairfax. In Northern Virginia, there aren't too many. This is the first thus far, and the only one we'll have thus far.
The family-owned restaurant is named after Zishan Ahmed's grandfather. In Uyghur language, Irkin means freedom and independence. With that spirit, after years as a caterer for the Uyghur diaspora, Zishan's uncle, Chef Musa, decided to open a restaurant. The Uyghur American Association estimates that there are 15 million Uyghurs living in Xinjiang, which shares borders with 8 countries. That has enriched Uyghur culture and cuisine.
Our tribe is fairly nomadic. That's how they were kind of initially brought up, to be raised and living in gears and cooking around a fire with your family members and close friends around you. A lot of it is adapted from the areas around, such as kind of the rice coming on later.
The kawaplar, a lamb or beef kebab dish, heavily seasoned with cumin and chili powder, reminds the taste buds of Middle Eastern food. But the lekman, a hand-pulled noodle dish, is testimony to the Chinese influence. Curious non-Uyghurs also come to experience the cuisine.
Which is interested that it was a new restaurant, and then my husband was excited that it was a Uyghur place.
Along with halal food, non-alcoholic beverages are served, a perfect pairing after 16 hours of fasting in a foreign country. For Virginia Gunawan in Fairfax, Virginia, Ariadna Budianto, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia, concerned by the lack of any reference to human rights in the joint statement issued at the historic summit between Washington and Pyongyang, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on North Korea says this is the time for the U.S. to pressure North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on a human rights dialogue. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after years of research and $400 million from investors, Impossible Foods has produced the hottest new item on the vegan market. It's meat-free burgers, and they aim to deliver the pleasure people get from eating meat, but with no cholesterol, antibiotics, hormones, harmful bacteria, or meat. VOA's Faiza El-Masri has the story as Faith Lapidus narrates.
It looks like meat. It sizzles on the grill like meat. It tastes like meat, but it's not meat. It's the Impossible Burger, and it's entirely plant-based. It uses a fraction of the resources needed to get a burger from a cow, and many meat eaters admit they actually prefer it. The vegan burger has four major natural ingredients: wheat, which provides protein, potato protein, which binds it together, an essence of coconut that gives it its juiciness, and a special ingredient.
We're the only one who has this. It has something called heme, H-E-M-E. Turns out heme, which is in the blood of an animal, is also in everything. It's in plants as well. We figured out a way to make it from a naturally occurring source in a plant, and as a result, only the Impossible Burger can have the unique meatiness that you get from a burger from a cow.
Tal Ronan, chef and owner of Crossroads Kitchen, a high-end vegan restaurant in Los Angeles, calls it a game changer.
It's, you know, changed the way people perceive of what a plant-based burger can be. Even though we're a plant-based restaurant, we really do serve mostly non-vegetarians. So it's been very popular for our non-vegetarian customers.
Umami Burger, which specializes in gourmet burgers, is one of the thousands of restaurants now selling the Impossible Burger and says demand for it is increasing. That's good news for Impossible Foods executive David Lee.
We founded the company and we're running the company so that we can have an impact that can be seen from outer space. So in addition to the United States, we recently launched in Hong Kong, not just because it's a wonderful place that great foodies love, it's also a place that sets food trends across Asia.
The company's new factory in Oklahoma has the capacity to create more than 5.5 million Impossible Burgers a month, which means it's not impossible to imagine them appearing on more and more restaurant menus across the United States and around the world. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Many of our future products may take inspiration from a Yemeni student who has taken his passion for invention to a new level. He's built household appliances such as refrigerators, vacuum cleaners, and cooling fans out of cardboard. VOA's Mariama Diallo says, surprisingly, the boy's creations work very well.
This young man loves to build and fix all kinds of things, something he learned from his older brother.
I used to watch my brother Farson. He used to fix small things like light bulbs, cables, or small machinery. I used to sit next to him, and everything I learn is from him.
After his brother left for college, Ahmed Al-Mamari took his place. He uses his natural creativity and ingenuity to create working machines from materials that happen to be on hand.
We create things like the robot, the vacuum cleaner, the ATM machine, the gun, the electric drill, and the microscope using air power.
Even more impressive is that the things he builds all work. But Al-Mamari says there is still one dream he would like to fulfill.
My ambition for the future is to get an opportunity to study or receive a scholarship to learn and develop myself, and develop the things I made here from cardboard boxes into something made of steel or aluminum. God willing, I can develop myself to the better.
When he's not busy working on inventions such as this ATM machine, he looks for other work so he can earn money to help his family. Sometimes he serves tea at this local street cafe to make ends meet.
This is the only place where I can make money. I use that money to spend on the house and also pay for school tuition and exams.
Unfortunately, the boy's desire to take his passion for invention to the next level may have to wait. So far, there's still no end in sight to the war that broke out 3 years ago in Yemen between government forces and Houthi rebels. More than 10,000 people have died so far, and 3 million have been displaced. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast. Take VOA Asia wherever you go. Of course, we're streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website at voanews.com. We'd like to thank everybody who's also listening on the radio. If you're in the Philippines, check us out on Falcon Radio at Adamson University. We thank everyone there who tuned in today, as well as our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Zubir El-Tayeb. Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.